When I started learning the cello, I fell in love with the instrument because it seemed like a voice. My voice. So said Mstislav Rostropovich, one of the great cellists of the 20th century. But what does it take to bring out that voice of the cello? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
One requirement, of course, is talent, but that talent has to be honed. And what's the best way for a cellist to sharpen his or her talent? What practice techniques enable a cellist or any instrumentalist to be the best player possible? And what are some of the great pieces that work as builders of technique? Our guest is Benjamin Whitcomb, professor of cello and music theory at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater and the author of The Advancing Cellist's Handbook, a guide to practicing and playing the cello.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I see that in addition to the Advancing Cellist Handbook, you also have the Advancing Violist Handbook, Bassist Handbook, and Violinist Handbook. Before we go further into this world of teaching string players how to practice and how to bring out the voice of their instruments, what would you say to someone who's listening who does not play a string instrument and thinks, well, this program's not for me? What are they going to learn?
Well, I'd say nearly half of the book is geared towards practicing in general, just the aspects of mental preparation for practice, knowing what you want to accomplish, organizing your practice time, overcoming performance anxiety. A lot of those things are pretty universal to musicians as a whole. There's a fair amount of specific string stuff, but if we talk mostly about the stuff that is more broadly appealing today, hopefully those listeners will find something of use as well.
Well, as a cellist and a teacher of cellists, you obviously were addressing some problems that you had seen over the course of your career. So what were some of those problems, and what are the fixes that you recommend?
Well, it's funny. Yeah, I've been teaching private cello for about, 23, 24 years. And one of the pervasive things, as different as cellists are, among the things that are in common is that a lot of them, especially when they're young, don't know how to practice. And so this awful word that gets thrown around a lot, talent, what is talent really? A certain sizable portion of it is how you spend your time in the practice room. That thing about, well, 10,000 hours is what it takes to make an expert, I don't buy that. What are you doing in the practice room during that time? So I found that year after year, working with, and it wouldn't just have to be really young cellists either, working with more advanced cellists, intermediate cellists, they kind of didn't know what to do. Okay, I have this piece of music, I know I want it to get better, but how? So I kind of gradually found myself kind of preparing some papers on the topic and either publishing them here or there or presenting them. And then also just an additional stack of resources that I would hand out to prospective students. And I thought, you know, if I compiled these, I bet it would be a fairly useful handbook and resource and guide.
So you were asking your various students as they come into their lessons, how did you prepare for this lesson?
Right, right. And I would ask that question a lot. And after a while, I mean, that was revealing what their answer was. But then, you know, I'm thinking, well, there's even more to the answer that they're holding back from me, even if they don't know they're withholding. So after a while, I'd start a thing where on occasional lessons, I'd say, all right, look, you're going to practice for the next half an hour and just pretend I'm not here. Or in some cases, they record yourself practicing for a half an hour or an hour. And I just want to hear what it is that you're doing during that time. And I mean, I think all the music teachers out there are going to know what's coming here. Just starting at the beginning of the piece and going through to the end, go back to the beginning and repeat.
Right.
You know, it's called playing.
Yes,
exactly. It's the practicing that's not as much fun, is it?
Right. And then even the ones who, okay, well, I know to work on smaller sections. I know this passage gives me difficulty, so I'm going to work more on that. Like, okay, well, what is your brain doing while you're playing that passage over and over? And if it's daydreaming, if it doesn't really have a goal in mind, if there's not a feedback loop going on, they too would spin their wheels. So just zoning out, watching the clock. Oh, come on, clock, please. that sort of thing is just really not what you need your mind to be doing. And above all else, when we're practicing, we're training the mind.
I've always been amazed at that, the way you can sit down at the piano or with any instrument and be playing fairly complicated music, seeing the music, actually producing the sound, but thinking about something entirely different. It's interesting how the brain can divide that way.
Right. The Ohio State University had done a study that I read about. This was probably a decade ago, about where they would bring people in and play them just a movement of a Mozart piano sonata. And then they'd turn over their little questionnaire, and it was, what were you thinking about while that was going on? And whether they were music majors or not, they, by and large, were daydreaming. And so the study was, okay, well, what is it that gets them focused on the music? And so, I mean, that's, to me, that's very interesting as a performer. How do I get my audience? I put in enough hard work on this piece. I don't want them daydreaming. I want them paying attention to what I'm doing. But the same is at least as true, if probably not more so, in the practice room, that just to be mindless repetition and allow your brain to drift. I mean, in some ways, then it's no wonder that when you get on stage and your brain is, because of adrenaline, really in the moment, that you aren't in charge of the results,
Well, let me back up a step, Benjamin, and we've already used this word a couple of times, talent. And let's say I have a 10-year-old that I'm trying to get some music education for. How do I know, first of all, if they have any musical talent? And I mean, there is such a thing. Some students can pick up an instrument. I've seen this happen at these instrument petting zoos, where a student or child who's never touched a violin can pick it up and get sounds out of it, and another child can pick it up and not. Yeah. So there is such a thing as talent, although, as you say, it may be a small part of the equation. But how do I know that my child has talent enough to pursue a musicianship? And if so, how do I have a clue as to what instrument would be right for him or her?
Boy, that's a big question. I think as far as knowing whether a youngster has aptitude to advance on an instrument is very hard, at least for me. I don't think I can tell in just kind of a snapshot. So some of them who might initially get some nice sounds out of the instrument and look like they know what they're doing, of course, if their mindset and attitude are wrong or poor for advancement, then they're gonna go nowhere. So to me, in a way, what interests me the most are sometimes when somebody who seems to have a natural aptitude at a particular instrument and then doesn't go anywhere, and then someone that kind of looked really awkward initially, but through perseverance and hard work and a good attitude and a willingness to change, etc., is able to accomplish a lot. But it is true. There's, for example, with a bow hold, if you were able to bring a bunch of 10-year-olds by and have them all just open a doorknob counterclockwise, like one of those spherical doorknobs, you'd get a pretty good sense as to which ones are going to grab a bow like it's a club, or which ones are going to grab it in a where the fingers have some independence. Not the best at predicting along those lines who's going to go the furthest, but
wouldn't it be more a matter of ear? In other words, rather than being able to open the doorknob a certain way, which seems to be something you could teach, if you have a child that can sing back a melody right in pitch, it seems some of that is innate. Where it's where you have some people who are practically tone deaf who might love music but cannot reproduce the sound.
But you need the dexterity too, is that what you're saying?
You do. You need both. But the funny thing about the ability to match pitch or sing pitches back or have a good sense of intonation, I teach ear training among other things at UW-Whitewater as well. And it's interesting to me how some of them maybe can sight sing quite well, and maybe can tell when they're the listener that this note is sharp and that note is flat. But there, it's as though some people, and not a small number of people, have some sort of a mental block. When they get an instrument in their hand, they'll sit on a note that's out of tune, and they have good ears, but that feedback loop, in other words, it's like the mind is just such a complex thing. I think you can still have somebody that has what you'd think would be the outward indications of the pitch sense and the dexterity. And, okay, that makes them certainly much more likely to succeed. But in the grand scheme of things, those can easily be outdistanced by somebody who isn't as advanced in those but really has a good practice strategy and ethic and knows mm-hmm. what they want to do. Yes.
Well, let's take the Bach that we opened with. If we could go back to that a bit and let's say the goal is to be able to play that piece better, mm-hmm. be able to perform it, be able to move the audience and create a beautiful piece of music. What would you do with a student that you had in your studio to make the practice time lead to that result?
Well, I've got a total of 16 chapters and a couple of appendices in each of these books. And so some of them are fairly short chapters. I think the one that is kind of the meat and potatoes, so to speak, of the whole book is chapter 6, which I call Practice Techniques. And I outline 7 different strategies for practicing. So just even that opening of the Bach suite, how they might apply some of these ideas, just a quick run through each of them. There's some of them apply more than others to any given piece. So one of the strategies is transposition. If you can take a piece and transpose it to each of the 12 different keys, well, you have a good sense of that piece. But that's not as useful with the Bach suites with a lot of open strings. You want to use those open strings. But in a case like this, one of the things that often crops up is just the students will repeat the first measure over and over and just kind of hope that it gets better rather than either simplify the passage in some way, shape, or form. So simplification is another one of the strategies. Rather than try and tackle everything at once, the left and the right hand, if they'll just isolate the right hand. So the piece starts out. And if they get any of those pitches out of tune, that bugs them, as it rightfully should. They should be concerned about intonation. But if you want to get their brain wholly focused on what the right hand is doing, just have them give their left hand a break for a while and just work on the smoothness of those bow changes. So that's simplification. And another idea I use a lot, I call it standard comparison. And what I mean here is like the standard is as in a gold standard, something by which to measure something's value. So, for example, rather than constantly, and this is another thing that musicians tend to do, is we tend to be perfectionists, and so we tend to beat ourselves up a lot. And I think the thing I like best about this standard comparison strategy is that what you're doing, above all, is looking for things in your playing that you really like. Oh, I love my vibrato at this spot. Oh, I love the way I do this shift, or whatever it is. And then the idea is to take that quality and transfer it everywhere else. And that's a building up kind of a thing rather than tearing yourself down. So that opening, basically to get it as smooth as we want it to, if we can get the student to play it like they would play the fourth movement of the same suite, starts out with just rolled chords. So to play, that is a broken chord. And if I gradually go from that to 3 individual notes, it's a lot smoother than if I go like some of them will want to do. So that's the standard comparison idea. You can point and say to a student, even a 10-year-old will respond wonderfully if you say, "Ooh, I love the way you roll this chord. Can you do that for me again? Ah, don't you love that sound? That's so smooth. Now do that and then do this first bar again. Now do that and do this first bar." And sometimes without even knowing how they're doing it, they're somewhere in their brain, there's a part of the brain wanting to make whichever is the weaker of the two live up to the better of the two.
But you're comparing yourself to yourself,
exactly.
Not to some gold standard of another cellist.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what are the
What are the techniques that these beginning cellists have to take on? You've given us a couple of ideas, but these come from Bach, which Bach is sort of a favorite, or used to be, for piano teachers to start with. What is it about the music of Bach that makes it such a good teaching device, do you think?
Wow. Well, I think in the case of us cellists, the Bach suites are, I mean, if there is anything that's the equivalent of the Bible of our repertoire, it is those Bach suites. I mean, I can't think of any part of the repertoire in which the cello repertoire is more famous than the violin equivalent, you know, but the Bach Bach suites managed to accomplish that.
Maybe Casals helping out there.
Yeah,
he sort of discovered them, really.
That's
didn't
true.
He?
Casals was the original Yo-Yo Ma, right?
Interesting.
But Bach is also, he's, for things like smooth string crossings or clean shifts or just a number of things with really kind of natural sounding intonation and resonance, where it's just kind of the right level. You have to get those things right in order for it to sound well, but it's still technically within the student's means. Within these books, I picked 5 or 6 pieces at the back of each one. I tried to pick very common pieces that I felt most kind of advancing or intermediate youngsters would end up playing at some point. And so for the cello, that was an obvious pick. But
it is a solo piece, for one thing. You don't need to worry about getting a pianist or an orchestra.
That's right. That's a plus. When you're practicing it in the room, you're hearing all the forces that will be performing it. That's right.
My piano teacher told me that I couldn't move on to Beethoven and Chopin until I got Bach down, because with Bach, you don't get to hide behind a sort of nice pedal being held, mushy sounds, you know, romantic, anything. It's very pure and exposed.
Right, that's true. And, you know, it's Mozart gets kind of the credit as being, at least the story I've heard over and over, the anecdote, oh, well, it's so hard to play Mozart because it's so exposed and has to be just so. But then, like, well, why isn't that also said about Haydn or Bach or, you know? Yeah, it's equally true there, yes.
You mentioned that there were 7 techniques that you bring up about practicing. What are some of the ones we haven't talked about that you would work with a student in your studio with?
Mm-hmm. So another example is exercise creation. A lot of students, again, even if they know that they shouldn't be just starting at the beginning and going through to the end, it is, my heart goes out to them to a certain extent. The whole point of music is to keep going through the piece. But for some of them, it's just so difficult for them to make themselves stop. So if you assign them, no, you're to come up with a up to 5 note or up to 8 note, set some sort of parameter excerpt from this difficult passage that you will do in kind of some ostinato form, or break it down and apply different techniques to it. So exercise creation, knowing how to take a difficult passage and dissect it and make your own, in essence, little etudes out of whatever it is that's tripping you up, is a very useful skill. Another one I list is slow practice. And I mean, slow practice is just one of those that it's just, I think, 200 years from now, it's going to be hard to get youngsters to go slowly through a piece. And one of the things I find ironic about slow practice is I think some of the times the reason why they don't want to do slow practice is because they don't, they think, oh, well, I don't have the patience to go that slowly. But personally, the reason why I do slow practice is I don't have the patience to go back and fix bad habits that crept in when I tried the piece too fast early on. So sometimes explaining that to them can help. Then there's also add a note technique, which is just add hyphen a hyphen note. And so sometimes what is, you know, they can get a concerto, for example, or even if it's not a concerto, but they can get a somewhat faster or flashier piece to sound pretty good, except for this technical spot or this technical spot. It's often a run of some fast notes. And rather than to take the whole passage and just slow it way down and then gradually work the metronome up, which is a useful skill, but I think that's fairly intuitive. A lot of them know to do that on their own. This is take the passage at tempo and start with the first note perfectly, and then if that's perfect, now play the first two notes of the passage and then the first three notes.
I thought you meant add more notes than were on the page.
Yeah, so if it's a 10-note run, get those first two notes and then the first three notes. And one of the things that I like about that is it tends to show them right away where the exact problem is. They think, I'm not good at this run. But what it really is that they're not good at shifting from this F sharp to this G sharp. And then once they know that, then they can start, well, what am I doing at that moment? Oh, I see. I'm really tensing up right at that, or whatever the case is. I mean, it's somewhat detective work. And then finally, the last one is conceptual or theoretical practice, which maybe reveals my background as a theorist too. But I want to have students do a certain amount of time, put in a certain amount of time understanding whether it's the form of the piece or all the intervals that they're hearing and that they're shifting. Just sometimes it's kind of surprising to me how maybe a very bright student just has not put any thought into that. And so the first time you ask them, so what's the form? Where are we in the piece? And they just give you that blank look, like, what do you mean by that? So conceptual and theoretical practice can help them, I think, in some cases more than they realize. In fact, I have a whole chapter on practicing without your instrument, just that mental practice, which I love to have them do at those times. Yeah. Even though we string players, we can practice usually several hours a day without hurting ourselves. You still get to a point where you have to pack it up for the day, but don't fear. You can still practice.
How do you practice without an instrument?
Well, one of the things is to do score study. I think students often are, say, when they have something that they have to play with a pianist, the pianist gets to see all of the notes that the pianist and the student has, and the student is ignorant of what the pianist is playing. So to follow along a recording and watch the piano part and not their part, for example, there are also obviously listening to different interpretations. I like to have them listen to at least three to make sure that they're not accidentally or inadvertently copycatting a particular interpretation. Reading books about music. There's a lot of excellent stuff out there that's been written about technique. And, I mean, to a certain extent, there are a number of things that really need to be demonstrated to be understood, but there are also a lot of things that don't, that if you read a good book about, it can help a lot to understand it. Sight singing. Any ear training work that you can come up with, going to concerts, going to other people's lessons. And there's even technical stuff that you can do. For example, on the with the cello, we need a lot of strength in the fingers of the left hand. And so there are various exercises, just whether it's squeezing a racquetball or things to strengthen the muscles without allowing any double-jointed fingers to collapse.
One thing you haven't mentioned is the emotional component, how you feel about the music. We'll talk about other ideas for practicing and advancing as a musician when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Benjamin Whitcomb, who is giving us some insights into what I'll call the art of cello performance and practice. And practicing, of course, is all important, as any teacher will tell you, whether it's in music or any number of other disciplines. But practice can be something that seems to me is a little dry, a little centered on technique rather than spirit. And so what part does responding emotionally to a piece of music play in the practice and the development of it, do you think?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I've tried to make the whole book about the musicality first. It seems a number, especially youngsters, but not just youngsters, tend to want to practice by learning the notes and the rhythms. Oh, don't bother with me with musicality yet. I'll get there. I'm still learning the notes and the rhythms. Mm-hmm. Now, what was that about music? You know, so they think if they sprinkle some music on top afterwards, hopefully that will stick, as opposed to infusing it from the beginning, which I think is the only way that it's really going to sound natural. And besides that, sometimes trying to explain to them how they're making more work for themselves that way on a string instrument, if you later decide, oh, all right, now I need to crescendo more here, well, now that means that you're going to have to do your bowing a little bit different way. I mean, you're making more work for yourself. So, for example, on each of the walkthroughs of these six pieces in the Advancing Cellist Handbook, I start them out with musical considerations. Now, how are you going to what do you consider to be the high point of the piece as a whole, and how are we going to make that the high point? Also, I have a section devoted to musicality, and it's by no means a comprehensive section on everything I think about musicality, but in a way I wanted to include things that I figured most intermediate cellists had not necessarily thought about. So, for example, what does it mean when they see simplice versus con fuoco in their music? A lot of times they just blow by that.
That's and, so true, isn't
and
it?
And so I try and define it, and then I compare and contrast them with other terms, and I talk specifically about, now this is probably going to mean more vibrato and a faster bow or closer bridge or whatever it is to make these different terms come out. In fact, we have a game that is pretty popular with the studio. We don't do it every year, but probably about every other year in my cello studio at UW-Whitewater, where we'll draw one of these expressive marks out of a hat. Nobody else gets to see it. And you play the given passage of the day in that manner, and the rest of us try to guess. Mm-hmm. You know? Wow.
That's like the acting game where you act out a mood and people have to guess, were you angry or afraid or what kind of mood were you expressing?
Right. Yeah. So if they guess cantabile and you were trying espressivo, that's okay. Mm-hmm. But if you're trying to do cantabile and they guessed tranquillo, then maybe back to the drawing board.
What about a bigger issue in terms of musicianship? I think all of us have heard performances that were technically flawless, but it seemed as if the performer lacked a kind of soul. Yeah. And that's difficult to pin down, but it would not just be doing the you know, dynamics and sort of technically doing what's on the page, but just that feeling you have of an artist who is connecting to the emotion of the music.
Right. And that can be a challenge in a way, because if you took two students who seemed otherwise identical in terms of their technical level and even mental state, attitude and such, you could say the same thing to the both of them. And for one, it would click and they'd start suddenly playing in a very musically moving and significant manner, and the other one wouldn't. So it's like, what it takes to make that click with any given individual, that last bit of inspiration so that they get it, certainly does vary from person to person. I think one of the things I'm trying to do in these books is if I can get them to lay all the fundamentals and the groundwork for that moment to occur. And again, that's also going to vary. For some of them, some of them really love modern music, and some of them really love early music, and some of them really love jazz, for example. But let's say another thing in this chapter 14 on playing musically, where I try and get them, I list not just happy and sad as a couple different emotions that we're going to try and emulate, but all sorts of adjectives for happy and all sorts of ones for sad. And likewise, then in the section on the language of music, can you emulate these various vowel sounds and these consonant sounds? So if they get to where they can do that, then their toolbox hopefully will be complete for the moment that they hear whatever it is that makes it click for them. And now they want to, you know, they have something from inside them that they want to say with their musical instrument.
These two, musicality and technique, have to be side by side from the get-go. But
yes,
they certainly have to have, I believe you're saying, the technique in order to sort of forget concentrating on the technique so much and let the emotional overlay of the piece win out eventually. I mean, the technique is not supposed to be that conspicuous. It's supposed to be the emotions created by the technique.
Right, right. Well, and I think a lot of them think that technique is getting to where your hands play the right notes at the right time. But technique should also be about playing it with the right articulation and the right color and the right inflection. So if they really, I mean, if technique includes all of those things too, so you think about somebody who is, let's say, destined, when they finally become a great actor, maybe part of when you interview them about, well, how did you get to be a great actor, that if they worked on imitating different types of personalities and even different accents from around the world, those would be technical things, but then that they used once their muse started telling them how to interpret a particular character in a particular way.
A lot of it has to do with phrasing, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if I were to say, and I've heard people say something like, you know, in Flanders fields the poppies grow between the crosses row on row. Well, okay, you've got the words down, you got the rhymes down, but you don't have the phrasing down, and you certainly don't have the dynamics down.
Yeah.
Can you demonstrate? I'm trying to find an excuse to get you to demonstrate something again on your cello because I love hearing the sound of it.
Right,
can you demonstrate a phrase done with different sort of emotions behind it?
Yes. Well, I think maybe if we were to hear the Elgar Cello Concerto, that's one that I like to work with students on for musicality quite a bit, and they often tend to fall into the same kind of sterile traps. Could we hear that, and then I'll play some excerpts from it?
Sure. How's the beginning of this Elgar Cello Concerto marked?
Oh, I don't have that in front of me, I'm afraid.
You know, I mean, we could sort of, it's obviously not, you know, Allegro Passionato, but there's some intensity to it, and certainly, would you say it a cantabile quality to it?
Yeah, but it starts out with a chorus coming out to do a prologue before a play. So, for example, I like to have students start at the main tune that we just heard, the mi, fa, mi, sol, la, sol, fa. And then once we have that figured out, because that's the main tune that keeps coming back throughout the movement, then you look at this introduction and try and figure out, now, why would Elgar have written this here? What's it doing? What's its function? Because if you don't understand the meaning of what you're trying to say, then you're just parroting things or saying things robotically. So we have basically two little ideas in this introduction. And the first one has these chords and these grace notes, which tend to be all that the youngster focuses on. So this is one example of where I would have them do simplification to find, all right, well, what's the real tune that's going on so that they know how they want to shape it. So here's how I often hear it, just where the chords in and of themselves are just these separate events that seem kind of to go nowhere. Just like these isolated events. So I say, okay, no. Just no chords, no grace notes. Just play me the tune. And once they figure out the tune and singing it, having them sing it, of course we can't sing these triple stops and quadruple stop chords, but we can sure sing a tune like that. And you have them sing it, and they're, oh, really, do I have to sing? Yes, you have to sing. Everybody has to sing.
A lot of them so reluctant, aren't they,
right,
to
yes.
sing.
And then try and get them to do as, okay, well, can you sing it any more expressively than that? Oh, are you going then to this bar? I hear you going to this bar. Oh, can you sing it then even more going to that? So we kind of unearth the shape that they're feeling with that particular melody. And now they have kind of, you have to know what you want whenever you're practicing, just practicing for its own sake. I think that's one of the reasons why some people, oh yes, I used to take piano as a kid or whatever the instrument is, but then I gave it up. Well, why'd you give it up? I like to ask them. And if they kind of didn't know why they were doing it or what they wanted to accomplish. So if you want to try and bring out that melody, despite those chords and ornaments, now you're not just going, all right, well, on the recording, I heard the person get louder here, and I heard them accent this note a little bit and wait a little bit here. Well, how long do you wait? Well, you're imitating what you sang, hopefully. And then this next little bit, this little segue into the main tune is, I mean, this wonderful potential for building up suspense. And again, a lot of them miss it. If it's not pointed out to them, we have this. And as far as the listener knows, we're just going to keep on going up the scale. We don't know where that's going to end. So to get them to try and do it as though the, oh, now this is the last one. Oh, wait, one more. Oh, wait, one more. So sometimes we might practice taking that scale on up even further and, you know, just see what it would have been like if you'd have kept going. Now, when you stop on that F sharp, it's kind of has a almost a whimsical quality to it that way.
Less predictable.
Yes, exactly. So hopefully from the heart. But I don't think they can get there just simply by saying, all right, well, I've heard my three favorite recordings, and I think this person's length of time is what I'm going to choose to copy. Like, no.
One of the things that has always struck me about practicing an instrument is what a lonely task that is. Now, if you're there as a teacher and it's broken up with a back and forth and now do this and let's hear that, it's a shared thing. But then if you take a youngster and parents say, okay, go practice a half hour, and they go to their room, and there they are for that half hour. It is a lonely kind of time. What do you do to sort of combat that isolation?
Well, isn't that interesting? I mean, there's no small number of youngsters who actually seem to like that. You know, I mean, they, oh, good, it's my quiet time. You get some time in which there's no siblings or friends or parents, and they get, it's like meditation in a way. Mm-hmm. So for a certain number of them, I don't think we need to try and save them from that. To others who are very social folks, to me, my favorite thing is to think chamber music thoughts under such circumstances. And what I mean is, I mean, if you if the student is able to play in a trio or a quartet or something like that, then even when the student is practicing a part by him or herself, you can, like, whether it's by having a mirror in the room or just even having the student practice looking over at the person from whom they're taking a given cue or passing a cue. And then when you go back and take the Bach suite that we started with, Bach is full of compound melodies, which means basically more than one melody wrapped into one. And you can look at those instances as like you're playing a duet, or maybe you were playing a duet with somebody and then they got called home and now you're going back and forth between the two parts. So you can still do things, in other words, even with a monophonic line, that are being done in a conversational manner, so it doesn't have to feel like just in a void and lonely.
Is all music, do you think, cello music, if we want to limit it to that, music that has some kind of emotional content that you have to convey? I'm thinking of, you know, endless, for example, piano sonatas by Haydn, say, where other than the possible exception of the slow movement, it's like, well, okay, we're just kind of, you know, going through various harmonies and various tricks of the pianist here, but it's not like I have a sense of, gosh, this is some emotional scene going on in every movement. Some of them just seem a little more abstract, I guess is what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, I suppose so. But I do think that, I mean, for my money, I'm only going to be interested in playing it or hearing it performed if it does have emotion in it. But, I mean, it's kind of funny. You mentioned Haydn, and I think in some cases, maybe the listener has to kind of find where the emotion is. So in something, a big, lush, romantic piece, it is spoon-fed to you. You are hit over the head with it, right?
Yes.
Whereas in something like Haydn, where he's constantly kind of tricking you or playing with your expectations with the form, for example. So it's like having a conversation with a very, very clever person and trying to be able to appreciate the nuances of their ability to just put in little, whether it's humorous things or subtle suggestions. So it's not... I think, in a way, that's why the few times that I've gotten to teach a class on introduction to classical music, the romantic stuff is, oh, yes, people seem to like that right away. And the Baroque stuff, they seem to like that right away. And overall, I'd say the last period, time period, to really catch on with a lot of folks is that 1750 to 1800. You have to really be paying attention to subtlety. And maybe it's just somewhat this day and age where we don't have to be so focused on nuance most of the time in our lives, most of us.
That's true, and it's harder to get, a thunderous ovation after you're playing a piece by Telemann as opposed to the Elgar Cello Concerto, for example.
That's true.
Another excerpt that you often work with is called The Swan, and we'll look at that when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Benjamin Whitcomb, and we are talking about approaches to learning the cello, how to advance your skills. His book is called The Advancing Cellist Handbook. One of the other excerpts that you talk about in your book, besides the Bach and the Elgar, is The Swan. Tell us about that and what you do with it with your students.
Oh, this is... actually, there are a number of kind of must-play pieces as an advancing cellist, and probably easily a couple dozen that oh, what? You've never played thus and such a piece? You know, everybody plays it. And the Swan from Saint-Saëns' Carnival of the Animals is one of those pieces. It's just a short piece that in some ways captures, I think maybe personifies what people like best about cello. When people say, oh, I love the cello, they're generally not talking about some flashy virtuoso piece by Popper. They're talking about something that's long and lyrical and sounds like a tenor voice. So this piece is definitely that.
Back to what Rostropovich said at the beginning.
Right.
It reminded him of a voice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So let's hear this one.
The cellist there, by the way, Mats Lindström with the Swan by Saint-Saëns. It seems to me, Benjamin, that phrasing is the most important part of that. But, of course, you have to have a very pretty singing tone along with it.
That's right. Yeah, it's a nice... I mean, it's only 27 measures long, but it's a nice tour de force in terms of the musical devices that we want a youngster to have at his disposal. So, for example, opportunities to just show off the phrasing and legato sostenuto sound. Also, types of shifts. Can you do an expressive shift that sounds like the way the human voice would get from place to place? How's your vibrato? And
little bit of vibrato in there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's kind of all in that short piece. So, for example, in a case like this, a student who diligently manages to get all the right pitches in the right order and play them with the right rhythms still might play things rather, something like this, maybe. It where it's just kind of not only all one-dimensional, but the colors, kind of certain notes pop out more than others. Just on the cello, as with a number of instruments, you have to do some extra work with your hands in order for you to be in the driver's seat as to which notes are brought out more and which notes are what color. So that's another good example of how I would have them do what I call standard comparison. All right, would you play it now with this fingering or play this pitch on this string and see what that sounds like? And now if you're going to use your fingering, can you keep the sound of this other of this other note? So for example, instead of an open A, which is so bright and kind of ah, like the A sound, ah, but we want oh or ooh. So if you go rather than, you get on the D string, that sound is much more of a ooh sound. So to, again, we're not trying to tell the student, oh, you did this wrong or something. We're saying, doesn't that, don't you sound even warmer or rounder, or don't you love the sound even more, more beautiful if you play it here? And then explain, well, now you don't have to necessarily do it there, but now you've got this this image in your mind's ear that you're going to make happen regardless of exactly where on the instrument you play it.
And final words for anyone who's saying, I'd love to be a musician, but I hate to practice?
Well, I'd have to say I'd encourage them to read my chapter on the psychology of music. I'm, in some ways, maybe I'm most proud of that chapter. I mean, it's a, maybe a little bit on the philosophical side, but in 11 pages, I try and address issues of attitude towards practicing, attention and concentration, motivation, knowing why you want to play a musical instrument. And, you know, so you do some soul searching at the beginning of the book, which hopefully puts you in a better mindset for what the other things that are in the book and try and, I mean, the idea is in the end, I think you're only going to be looking for a book on practicing if you know that there's something about the way you practice that could be improved. So if you go into the book with that attitude, I'm hoping everybody will at least come away with a few things that will make them get more, not only more out of any given hour of practicing, but more enjoyment out of it, too.
Well, it's been an enjoyable hour with you, Benjamin Whitcomb.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And the author he is of the Advancing Cellist's Handbook and various companion volumes pertaining to other instruments, too, other stringed instruments. Been very insightful, and I'm sure that we'll all be better practicers from now on. Thanks for the tips.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for our next hour of University of the Air.